Robert Kopp, thank you so much for talking with us here. You are the co-author of a new study and evolving understanding of Antarctic ice sheet physics and ambiguity in probabilistic sea level projections. What does that title boil down to?
So probabilistic sea level projections, that's basically a question of asking how likely are different levels of sea level in the future. And the ambiguity arises because what we find is that beyond 2050, our projections of sea level rise are very sensitive to some our understanding of physics that's evolving very quickly. So through 2050, lots of different ways of calculating projections of sea level rise basically agree. We look at two in this paper, that we're somewhere between about half a foot and 1.3 feet of sea level rise between 2000 and 2050. But beyond 2050, there's some new physics people are thinking about in the Antarctic that have the potential to vary the range of what might happen from anywhere from 1 to 3 feet under a low emission scenario and sort of a conservative way of estimating to 4 to 7 feet under high emissions and taking into account some of this new physics. So that's an example of what we call ambiguity or deep uncertainty. And it poses some challenges as we think about planning for that future.
And we should let our listeners know that because we're on the East Coast here with the Atlantic Ocean, that those projections are even higher for us. Tell us what we could expect under the lower and the higher emission scenarios and why it's different than the global average.
Yeah, so it depends on where you are. But just to go to one in member, those high-end numbers can get as high as about 10 feet on some places on the East Coast, like coastal New Jersey, where you've got a constellation of factors amplifying sea level rise. These include natural processes, like the ongoing effect to the end of the last ice age, processes that are caused by humans but somewhat local, like compaction of the land that's caused by pumping out groundwater. And something that's important for these projections, because of the way when you move mass around on the surface of the Earth, when you melt Antarctica, the coastal U.S., which is relatively distant from Antarctica, experiences about 30% more sea level rise than the global average. So all of those factors combined to mean that the high-end risk for some places on the east coast of the U.S. could be as high as 10 feet by the end of the century.
And does that include Long Island Sound, for example, eastern Long Island and southern Connecticut?
So it's a little bit lower than that, probably for those regions. I'd have to pull up the numbers, but probably more in the 9 feet of high-end risk, because compared to some places further south, there's less of an exposure due to groundwater withdrawal because you're mostly sitting on more solid bedrock. But it's still, you know, it's a pretty high-end number in the east coast of the U.S., does get more sea level rise than the global average, especially when large amounts of ice are coming off of Antarctica.
Now, break this down for us in terms of the numbers of people that this is going to affect. I mean, it's going to affect millions of people either way, but there's quite a jump in the numbers.
Yeah, so let's just focus on sort of the median projection for two different emissions futures. So a low emission future, one that's consistent with the vision laid out by the Paris Agreement, which brings net global greenhouse gas emissions to zero in the second half of this century, and a high emissions future, one consistent with continuing to burn fossil fuels unchecked. Our estimate is that the former case, the low emissions case, would, by the end of the century, flood land that's currently home to about 100 million people, whereas the second case would flood land currently home to 150 million people. Now, you have to realize, right, that's not people who are going to be flooded instantaneously, right? That's the land that's going to be flooded and where the people are now. And so it's not as though we're going to expect a sudden tsunami of 150 million people moving. Those are people who are going to have to gradually relocate over the course of the century. But nonetheless, that gives you a sense of what's at stake here, of the way that our coasts are going to be reshaped.
Wow. So, and in terms of the numbers, the millions of people that this would affect, I mean, we're really talking about a huge number of climate refugees.
Yeah, well, so again, I mean, I think we have to be careful when we think about this, right? Because those are the people currently living in the land that would be flooded. Mm-hmm. But this sea level rise, this is a century worth of sea level rise, although actually on those high-end scenarios, almost all of that happens after 2050, but there's still half a century worth of sea level rise. So most climate refugees are probably going to be one of two things. Either they will be post-disaster refugees, right? Refugees who are moving after, say, a hurricane, that the flooding of which is made worse by sea level rise. Or they're economic refugees. You know, just when it starts flooding somewhere, you know, small flooding 20 times a year makes it a little costly to live there, so people move. But they'll be moving for a constellation of reasons, one of which includes this economic cost associated with repetitive flooding. But many of them probably won't identify themselves as climate refugees. They'll identify themselves as moving to somewhere with better economic opportunity. So for New York City, we would project under a future with unchecked fossil fuel emissions, roughly 3 to 9 feet of sea level rise over the course of the century. Whereas under a future meeting the Paris Agreement goal, we would be looking more at 1 to 4 feet.
And we're talking with Robert Kopp, Professor Robert Kopp of Rutgers University, about a new study that he co-authored with several other scientists, some of them at Climate Central. Now, you say in the paper that it's difficult. You know, there's ambiguity right in the title there. It's difficult to really know what's going to happen after 2060. First of all, what makes the rate of change jump so suddenly in the mid-century?
Right. So the key new thing in the study is that we're using a model of the ice sheets that includes a couple of modes by which the Antarctic ice sheet can become unstable. And this is going to get slightly technical, but bear with me for a second. One of those is called marine ice sheet instability. So the idea there is basically you have warm ocean waters eating away at an ice sheet from underneath, setting in process a vicious cycle that can continue for quite a period of time, and a process that, in fact, may already be active in some parts of West Antarctica. Then there's a mechanism that has been less considered in sea level rise projections called marine ice cliff instability. And that's what happens if you have an ice sheet that has some floating ice, an ice shelf in front of it, that can get lost relatively quickly, as we saw back in 2002 with the Larsen B ice shelf. And when it gets lost, it can leave exposed to the open ocean a large cliff of ice that could be 300 feet tall. But ice is only strong, so if you have that large cliff, it's vulnerable to collapse under its own weight, and that'll cause this rollback process. So those two processes are the ones that we've incorporated into our projections that are driving some of these high numbers, you know, the 4 to 7 feet in a high emissions future for the end of the century, relative to what we would have projected before, which would have been more like 2 to 4 feet for a high emissions future. But those new physics are really cutting edge, you know, particularly that ice cliff instability is very cutting edge and very controversial, which gives rise to what we call deep uncertainty in these sea level rise projections. I'm not willing to tell you that 4 to 7 feet is definitely the better projection than 2 to 4 feet because the state of the physics is evolving so quickly. So what that means is that when we're thinking about what to do after 2050, where the sea level rise projections are really still quite well constrained, we have to think about the fact that the physics could go either way. We'll learn more. But one of the things we also found is that we really need fundamental advances in the physics if we want to narrow that down. If we just want to learn by watching what's going on as sort of the ice sheets as a whole or sea level as a whole, that won't narrow the projections down until the second half of the century.
It's been my experience, and I've been following this for quite a few years now, that sea level rise predictions almost always go in the more drastic, not the less drastic, direction. So maybe you can't answer this, but would you imagine that this uncertainty could mean even a much greater sea level rise than what we're talking about, rather than less, given the historical record?
Well, I mean, I think that historical record is interesting. I actually have a postdoc who's working on a project looking at that historical record of past projections. And what you see is that actually from 1982, when the first sea level rise projections that we know of in the published literature were made, until about the mid-2000s, the range actually narrowed significantly. The bottom numbers didn't shift that much, but the top numbers came down a lot. And then since the middle of the 2000s, they've expanded considerably, such that our range is probably not very different than what it was back when people started thinking about this. So that's an example, perhaps, of overconfidence, sometimes what people call negative learning, meaning as we learn more, our projections narrow, but then there's other things that we haven't learned about that are excluded, or erring on the side of least drama, which is a recognized tendency in scientific assessments. But I would say at this point, some of this new physics has pretty profound effects, but there are other physics that we know aren't yet incorporated in the models that could slow down or modulate it. So it's possible the numbers could go up further, but it's also quite possible there's other physics that will drag it back down a little. And that, again, is really what we're talking about, deep uncertainty. These numbers are going to bounce around for a while. And so if you're thinking about managing risk, you have to deal with the fact that, you know, we're still learning a lot. But if you have to be making decisions now about infrastructure that's going to be around for 80 years, like, you can't just wait for our uncertainty to resolve itself. You have to make decisions based on what we know today.
Right, and maybe should make decisions based on worst-case scenario. You know, one question about what might change things is, I know a lot of people have talked about the slowdown of the Gulf Stream. And I wonder if that's something that you incorporate, because, you know, there have been ideas that if it slows down or becomes stationary, then it's going to get much, much colder in the northern latitudes.
Yeah, so the Gulf Stream has an important influence on sea level in the northeastern United States. It is something that actually is represented in the models that we've used both before and in this study to project sea level rise. And when we were talking about why sea level rise was higher in the northeast, it's one I omitted, but you know, that Gulf Stream changes have the potential to add a foot or so to sea level rise in the U.S. Northeast over the course of the century. And if the Gulf Stream were to stop entirely, you know, that could go up to about 2 feet.
Wow. Now, the most shocking thing to me was actually looking further out than 2100. At 2200 and 2300, I mean, we act as if we have no responsibility to future generations. Even the time of our great-grandchildren, sea level rise could be 750 feet under the good scenario, I think.
It might be centimeters you're talking about there.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But that's very real. I mean, that, so we can talk about what my projections are saying, but another thing to think about is what's happened in the geological past. So 125,000 years ago, global average temperatures were probably roughly where they were today, maybe slightly warmer, and sea level was about 20 to 30 feet higher than today. Now, there was a lot that was different 125,000 years ago about things like the shape of Earth's orbit, so it's not a direct analogy, but it does sort of point to the long-term risk, even under relatively modest warming. In our projections, sort of the middle of the road projection for 2300 under a low emissions future is actually closer to about 5 feet, whereas for 2300, for a high emissions scenario, then you're getting up into that 30 plus foot range. But I think the geological record provides us a warning about sort of the long-term effects over many millennia, even of small amounts of warming.
So finally, what do we need to do? I mean, right now there's a controversy going on among the Paris, those who are in the Paris Agreement. Unfortunately, we are no longer in that agreement. A controversy over whether we absolutely have to use the 1.5 degree centigrade of global warming versus 2 degrees. What's your sense? How critical is this controversy?
Well, I would say that based on our projections, and in addition to the paper we've been talking about, we have another paper that was out led by Klaus Bitterman at Tufts University this week as well. Based on our projections, there is a huge difference in risk between a future in which we bring net greenhouse gas emissions to zero, which is a Paris goal that's sort of separate from the 1.5 or 2 degree goal, and one in which we allow fossil fuel emissions to grow considerably unchecked. So, you know, we've been talking about deep uncertainty. But if we're on that Paris-consistent goal, getting emissions down to zero, we don't actually see that in our projections. You know, we're in that 1 to 3 foot range by 2100, and Antarctica doesn't do very much different. What we found in the other study is that there is a difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees. It amounts to roughly 0.5 foot over the course of this century. And it amounts to a difference in the peak rate of how fast sea level rise is, the peak rate of how fast sea level rises, that's roughly comparable to the average rate over the last 100 years. So not insignificant, something that might make a difference between life and death for, say, some coastal marshes. But the huge difference is whether or not we make that goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions or not.
Well, that's an important distinction. Well, we've been talking with Dr. Robert Kopp of Rutgers University. You are the director of the Institute of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences there. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about this important new study that you have done, Evolving Understanding of Antarctic Ice Sheet Physics and Ambiguity in Probabilistic Sea Level Projections. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.